Esther 9, verses 23 through 25. The Jews undertook to do as they had begun and as Mordecai had written unto them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and to destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. We've seen, and we shall see, growing evidence in the last verses of the book of Esther that Mordecai was, in fact, rightly perceived by the Jews to be a prophet. Not only is he presented as inscripturating the story of the deliverance of the Jews during the period of exile under Persian rule, he is also very clearly the figure who is responsible for the institution of Purim, together with several of its practices. Now, the first, writing scripture, together with what we should consider to be throughout the book his infallible guidance and counsel throughout all the events that are recorded in Esther, all of that demonstrate that he's to be regarded as a prophet, especially when we consider his writing is prophetic and intended not only for that generation, but for all generations to come. But secondly, as noted, his authorizing of a holy day actually places him on a level that had previously been reserved to Moses. So before Mordecai, only Moses had appointed holy days for the Jewish people. Now, as we progress through this story, I've noted a couple of times that the word used here, toward the end of this chapter, I guess a little toward the middle of the chapter, for sending of portions in the feasting that followed the slaughter of the Jews' enemies, that word was often used to describe certain pieces of meat that had been reserved from the sacrifice of animals in the sacrificial system under Moses. Now, it's been pointed out that religious feasts have been connected with sacrifices since the most ancient times. In fact, it's hard to go very far throughout any of the commentaries or throughout any of the articles on these feasts without seeing that religious feasts have always been associated with sacrifice, particularly animal sacrifice. What is significant is this, that these sacrifices only became regulated with the establishing of the Mosaic Code. Prior to that, the patriarchs had offered sacrifices, but there was no real code. And so with the codifying of the rules regarding sacrifice, there's also the establishing under the Mosaic Code a series of religious festivals that are going to utilize the sacrifices of various animals, and they're going to do so to commemorate certain events that have to do with a couple of things. First, the formation of the Jewish Commonwealth. These these festivals have a lot to do with the establishing of the church and people of God as a nation. But they also typified certain doctrines which are now clearly revealed under the gospel. For example, if we look at the doctrine of the atonement for sin that's wrought by Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul reminds us in his letter to the Corinthians that Jesus Christ is our Passover. The Feast of Purim, established by Mordecai, speaks then of these sacrificial portions being sent. However, it's curious that they appear here in connection with the Feast of Purim, because they're present without the temple and its cultists. Remember, the Jews that are going to celebrate Purim, in the beginning at least, are in exile. So Purim not only speaks of the deliverance of the Jews, but Purim also, in some sense, contemplates a feasting somehow related to sacrifice, apart from a literal temple being in existence. And yet, the language, I think, insinuates that the efficacy of what that temple and its sacrifices typified is going to be found amongst the Jews in this Feast of Purim. Now, why is that important? Because, as I've said, I think that this Feast of Purim in particular is looking forward to the time of the New Testament and Messianic era, especially that time, that period, when the fullness of the Gentiles are brought into the feast together with the conversion of the Jews, shortly prior to and leading into that period of time we would call the millennium. Again, in that connection, I think we should see that the late establishing of the Feast of Purim and its peculiar establishing in the exile are also hints at the eschatological significance of this holy day. All of the other festivals of the Jews had been established by Moses at one time. Only this one is established authoritatively at a later time and apart from the literal temple. Now, again, it's important to note that Purim, like all of the holy days established under the Mosaic Law, Purim is a type and a shadow. It's designed to point the Jews to the gospel, specifically to Jesus Christ. So, with the coming of Christ, these holy days, together with all of the typical features of the Mosaic administration, are to be brought to an end. What this means is to return to all or any of these usages, as many who are in the current so-called Messianic Jewish movements do, or as various branches of those who adhere to what has been known as British Israelism tend to do, such as Armstrongism, the Worldwide Church of God, and its various splinter groups, or a certain what are known as Yahwehist movements that are among segments of various populations of people descended from African ancestry do. They try to establish these things as well. It's interesting that this impulse to Judaize can be found amongst such a diverse group of people. Virtually every group of people has some some portion of it drawn to this kind of very peculiar and very pronounced Judaizing. But to return to all of this is to bring men under a yoke of bondage, which the Apostle Paul says the Jews themselves couldn't bear. In fact, he goes on to say in his epistle to the Galatians that those who turn back to these kinds of things have fallen from grace and the truth of the gospel. For example, in Galatians 5, verses 1 through 4, he warns, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Behold, I, Paul, say unto you that if you be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. For I testify again to every man that is circumcised, he's a debtor to do the whole law. Christ has become of no effect unto you. Whosoever you are justified by the law, you're fallen from grace." In other words, he's saying, if you turn back to these Jewish elements, these Jewish ceremonial laws, you have rejected the gospel, you've fallen from grace, you are a debtor to the whole law. That is, as you're owning that law as a covenant of works. Now, let me just suggest that if it's a matter of falling from grace and the truth of the gospel, simply to retain holy days that God has appointed by his prophets, Moses and Mordecai, shall we suppose that when Christ and his apostles abrogated these days of God's appointing, that he was intending, or that the apostles were intending, that the churches should be allowed to substitute new holy days of men's appointment in their place? I mean, was the abrogation of the Mosaic ceremonies, again, appointed by God? Was the abrogation of that intended to be an opening for new ceremonies that are devised by men? How is it then that Rome and other high church traditions have managed to institute even more holy days than God did under that legal administration of Moses? You know, if you look at a liturgical calendar, almost every day is devoted to some feast, to some saint. Almost every day is technically considered a holy day. Now, they don't keep all of them. At least most people don't. But you have to ask yourself, what kind of administration is this that is saddling us with more holy days when we're told that the holy days of Moses and the holy days of Mordecai, that they were yokes of bondage? What kind of approach to the gospel is it then that would turn back to that sort of administration? Those who would derive a warrant for such institutions very often do so from the example of Mordecai in Purim. But they should consider that they've undertaken to do that which was reserved only to Moses and Mordecai. And both did so according to the express appointment of God as prophets. We're not to add to nor diminish aught from the things commanded by God, and that includes the invention of holy days. So Mordecai is not really a good example here, even though I know that there are a lot of people who go to this example of Purim and try to derive from it a precedent. Additionally, consider this. If it's now an offense against the gospel, such that Paul warned the Galatians in Galatians 4, 9 to 11, he says, "But now, after that you've known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto you desire again to be in bondage. Ye observe days and months and times and years. I am afraid of you, lest I bestowed upon you labor in vain. How much more should we take to heart these words when we consider that men today are not seeking necessarily to bring in Judaizing holidays, but they seek to bring in days and times that are actually derived from heathenism? Don't they see that in doing that, what they have is not a Christianized heathenism? They've only baptized paganism to the profanation of the church. We need to consider that what has arisen from the worship of devils, which is what these days were. Christmas is rooted in the old Saturnalia worship. Easter in Ishtar worship. So many of these are heathenish, idolatrous forms. It was strictly forbidden under the Mosaic economy to bring that sort of thing into the worship of God. That's a moral principle, and that principle remains. Look, Providence may call us to days of fasting and to days of thanksgiving. Our Directory for Public Worship sets out rules and regulations for observing both. But these days cannot be converted into annual recurring days without specific providential reauthorization. If we do, we're usurping divine authority in the matter. When Providence calls, and this is what Thomas McCree, I think, has wisely noted in this place, when Providence calls, the day is chosen for the duty. But when days are turned into recurrent or anniversary holidays, the duty is then performed for the day. You get the difference? Providence calls for days of fasting and days of thanksgiving. A day is chosen for the duty. But when these become anniversary recurrent holy days, annual recurring holy days, the duty is then performed for the day. Thus, stated in recurring festivals and holidays, countenance the false principle that some days have a peculiar sanctity, either inherent or impressed by the works which occurred on them. And it's for that reason that the Reformed Presbyterian Church has allowed no stated holy days except that of the Christian Sabbath. Now, lastly, to return to the theme of Purim, it's a feast appointed because during the month of Adar, the last month of the year, the Jews' sorrow was turned to joy. Thus, when I mentioned an eschatological note a few minutes ago, what I mean is this. I mean its appointment in the last month of the year, and by the way, several months after the other holy days and festivals. Okay, there were, until Purim, there were no holy days that were really kept in those last few months of the year for the Jews. I think it indicates the separation of time between the festivals which Moses ordained, which typified the coming of Christ, and this festival or feast of Purim, wherein the dispersed Jews are made to share in that deliverance shortly before the recurrence of the Passover, which occurs in the first month of the year, Nisan. Think about that. Passover's in the first month, Purim's in the last month of the year. So when the Jews are converted, it's going to be, as Paul notes, the taking away of the veil, which is over their hearts in the reading of Moses, and they will be partakers of the joy brought to light by the Messiah, Jesus. But that's going to come shortly before the millennium and will be one of the marks that we're entering the millennium. So let's look at verse 23. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them. The Jews undertook. The word translated here, undertook, has the sense of assuming an obligation. From this, it's understood that the Jews have embraced the Feast of Purim, together with the various practices that are outlined by Mordecai here. What we actually have is this: their embrace of Purim is being treated as what the Jews would call a mitzvah, right? A divine command obliging their careful observance. Actually, the Jews would say there are four mitzvot in Purim. The first is reading the scroll, or the book of Esther, the story, in its entirety. They're very, very careful in this matter. The second mitzvah has to do with the festive Purim meal, or the feasting that is to accompany the reading. The third is to do with the sending of gifts to one's neighbors. And by the way, they are clear that it should be at least two, and they're not to be the same. So if you are going to give a gift of some sort of meat, the other gift should be perhaps some sort of fruit. You're not supposed to give two kinds of fruit. Moreover, because this is a feast, and because of the festivities surrounding Purim, these food products that are very often given are not to be unprepared foods. So if you give someone a box of spaghetti, that would be wrong. But to give them a spaghetti and meatballs already made, that's okay. That could be one of the foods. But they don't want unprepared food. The fourth mitzvah is sending gifts to the poor. So, undertaking then is here the accepting of the obligation that's being pointed out to them, both providentially and prophetically, as we're going to see. It's both are taken into account in what's said in this verse. The fact that the faithful are all called by the name of Jews is something I think that is worthy of reflecting upon a little bit more than perhaps I have earlier in the book. But they're called by the name of Jews because the kingdom of Judah alone stood against idolatry when the 10 tribes in the north fell into that sin. Eventually, you know, the story, when you read in Kings and in Chronicles, you see the story unfolding, particularly in Kings. You see that the northern kingdom never has a good king. They're always involved in some kind of apostasy from God. Southern kingdom goes back and forth. They're struggling, but they do have good kings. And they avoid that kind of overt idolatry. And eventually the northern kingdom goes into captivity and into exile quite a bit sooner than the southern kingdom because of this idolatry. By the way, something else notable, and I may have mentioned this early on in the book, but one thing that is noted quite often in the history of the Jews subsequent to the exile, is that the exile, what happened to them in the exile, drove out of them this propensity to commit idolatry. They don't end up going back to having golden calves and things like that ever again. Anyhow, so what we see here is this. The faithful covenant people, the Jews, perceived not only the goodness, but the lawfulness of establishing the Feast of Purim. Now again, this would be very hard to defend if Mordecai was simply acting and enjoining Purim on his own authority. Or even if Mordecai is considered here as establishing a holiday simply as a civil ruler, based on his civil authority. Faithful covenant people, Jews, do not assume obligations that are not grounded in divine authority. They don't assume obligations that are apart from or contrary to the law of God. So calling those who embrace this feast Jews reinforces this point that this is not an arbitrary appointment of a holiday or the appointment of a day that is somehow without divine sanction or authority. Purim is a faithful engagement with an obligation that is unquestioned by those defined as being themselves faithful, the Jews. So the Jews, we're told, are quick to adopt this as a received custom. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun. Well, here's the first part of what they received as an obligation. They're going to do that which they had begun to do. Which means what? Well, I think that what is being said here is they're quick to embrace the keeping of the 14th day of Adar. Now, that's what they had begun to do after they were able to rest from their enemies, if you remember the story. So what was done and what is acknowledged first here is the call of providence. And they're acknowledging in this call of providence the basis for what they're now going to assume as a customary obligation. Now, let me say a couple of words about what is translated here, they had begun. Actually, more literally, we could translate the clause something like this. To do that which they defiled, or to do that which they untied to do. Or which they defiled or untied to do. The Hebrew is really saying, which they defiled or which they untied to do. Now why that? It's actually quite an unusual word, I think, to be used here. But consider this. The fourth commandment calls for men to work 6 days and rest on the seventh. The idea then underlying the word used here seems to insinuate that the Jews, in keeping this day, had untied the obligation to work from that 14th day of the month. That was a work day, but they'd untied it from that obligation by resting. And in a sense, they had defiled that day meant for working by turning it into a day of rest when it had not been appointed to such, except by a providential call. We could look at it that way. But this word also means to free from an obligation. And I think that's also in view here. If we consider the state of man prior to the fall into sin, In the garden, God provided for man's sustenance. Man really had very little to do with all of this. It was really the provision of God. But when man took the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what he did was he sought to provide for his own sustenance independently of God. And thus, in cursing the man, God said this, "By the sweat of your brow you shall now eat." The Sabbath day, then, and other holy days which are appointed by God, turn man's independent mindedness back to the thoughts of his sustenance when still in paradise, that it's dependent upon God. And, by the way, that's how it will be in paradise to come, if you look into the book of Revelation, for example. Purim then provided another reminder that work, although it was necessary, it's also cursed. And hence, finding a day of rest where previously there had been a day of work was, in that sense, to free man from an obligation. In its place, the Jews now assumed the obligation to rest and feast as unto the Lord. Now, in this, I should say, there is noted one thing wherein Purim differs from the keeping of the Sabbath, and that is this. The Jews allowed that the preparation of food was permissible on Purim. In fact, they actually allowed any kind of work to be done on Purim, but they discouraged it. They just thought it was an improper keeping of Purim. And that makes it very different from the Sabbath, where it was absolutely prohibited. But anyway, the Jews undertook to do as they had begun and as Mordecai had written unto them. Now, this clause indicates that the Jews had incorporated the observing of the 15th day along with that of the 14th day. So, it's the call of providence, but it's the call of providence which has now been confirmed and further refined or defined by the prophet of God. Here there's no discrepancy between what the Jews have begun to do and what Mordecai adds by way of command. By putting these things together, it's really meant, I think, to show that it all comes to one thing. Because this particular interpretation of providence has been confirmed by and defined by the prophet of God. In fact, what Mordecai has written is not only the book of Esther, but consider this, contained within that, he's given the various ordinances to be kept for the proper observance of the Feast of Purim. And yet, the noting of this being written by Mordecai on this occasion is why it is expected that the book or the scroll of Esther be read during the Feast of Purim. You're going to read it. Why? This is what Mordecai's written. He wrote this unto them. Now, this clause, by the way, the clause as it begins in this verse, a number of commentators, modern commentators in particular, note the style of the writer changes. And they say different forms of expression, different words appear, and this appears to be an appendix to the book of Esther written perhaps by someone else. I don't think that's the case, by the way, and I'll talk about that in the upcoming verses here. But this is what they think. The fact is, I think this appears differently, that the wording is different because this portion of the book contains several phrases and contains language which I think is intended to establish the authority of the Book of Esther as scripture within the Jewish community. But after all, how could the writings of Mordecai not be revered when the Jews knew that they were indebted to him for their very lives? And when they were made to reflect upon what had really happened and all of that, right? It's for this reason the Jews, I think, comply cheerfully with what was written because they have great regard for Mordecai's authority. He's what the Jews would have called a tzaddik, a righteous man. And he's a prophet. And in addition to that, they also had a clear sense of the divine mercy that had been showed to them in the routing of their enemies. So all of this is working together in this book. And particularly in this, some of these people would call an appendix. But let's look on the next verse. Because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and to destroy them. Because Haman, the son of Hammedatha. Now, it's in this verse and the next, really, that we see the author of the Book of Esther, I think, just simply doing this. He's distilling all of the facts relating to the Feast of Purim, including giving the reason for its name, which we'll follow in the verse, Lord willing, next week. But it's for this reason that there is this seeming repetition of the historical basis for the feast. It's really meant to be a thumbnail sketch of what has gone into this. Now, the mention of Haman again calls to mind his role in the story as the representative of the seed of the serpent. In fact, something I haven't mentioned before, but is this. Many of the rabbis believe that Haman personified the curse itself. If you remember in Genesis 3:11, the Lord God calls unto Adam and he asks him, "Hast thou eaten of the tree?" In the Hebrew, the phrase actually begins this way. It just says, "Haman ha'etz." Question, from the tree. Haman, from the tree. And the rabbis say, "Haman," oh, because Haman, because you ate from the tree, there will be a Haman for a curse. It's the same consonant letters there. In addition, we might also say, from what we know in the Book of Esther, that Haman, the curse, that he's going to be hanging on Ha'etz, the tree. The curse is going to hang on the tree. There's a curse because you ate from the tree, and that curse itself is going to hang on the tree. Now remember, Haman's name means great one. And we're told he was the son of Hammedatha, which, as I pointed out early on in the book, means given by a deity, and what is intended by the deity seems to be the moon god or something of that sort. And that brings out another contrast between him and Mordecai. Mordecai is a great one who's given by the true God. Haman is a great one given by an idol god or a devil. So there is in this contest, again and again, no small allusion to the various pairings throughout the Bible between men representing the seed of the woman versus those representing the seed of the serpent. Cain and Abel, Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, etc. In fact, as we're going to see in a couple of moments, It may well be that way back, Mordecai and Haman are actually related. I suppose if we go way back, we're all related because of Adam. Anyway, Haman must forever be associated with the curse, just as Mordecai is associated with the deliverance of the people of God. So let's look at this, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Once more, the name of Haman is tied here to that of Agag. And that's that reminder of the animosity between the Hebrews and the Amalekites. Now, interestingly, as I just alluded to, the Targums trace the genealogy of Haman back to Eliphaz, Esau's firstborn, if you look in Genesis 36:12. In other words, they make Haman the son of Esau. Mordecai, on the other hand, we know is a descendant of Jacob through Benjamin. Now, they not only find that significant, but in Genesis 33, we have early on in Genesis 33, I believe it's verses 3 and 6 and 7, Jacob and his sons are passing through Esau's territory, and they bow down before Esau, except for one of his sons, Benjamin, because Benjamin had not yet been born. And so one Targum actually has Mordecai say this: I'm descended from Benjamin. And when Jacob bowed down before Esau, Benjamin was not yet born. And he didn't bow down before any human all his days, as a result of which the Eternal One of the world guarded him in his mother's womb until the time that they would go up to the land of Israel and the temple would be rebuilt in its land and the Shekinah would dwell within its borders. And all the house of Israel would rejoice there, and all the nations will bow down and do obeisance in the land. And as for me, I shall not bow down and do obeisance before the evil Haman in front of this gate. So, the idea, and it was understood by the Jews, was this contest between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, which began with Cain and Abel, continues here through the offspring of Jacob and Esau. The Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews. Now, here the Jews are made to think about Haman as one who is not only the enemy of Mordecai, but he's actually portrayed here as the enemy of all the Jews. Now, there's no distinction made, by the way, between religious Jews or observant Jews who would not bow down and the rest of the Jews. And that's been a problem for the Jews down through history, by the way. You know, they really have never been able to escape their identity as Jews. And very seldom have their enemies ever made a distinction between observant religious Jews and what they might call secular or non-observant Jews. That's been the case from time immemorial. And it was the case that the realization that Haman was actually an existential threat to all Jews, whether or not they were observant, that caused there to be, under this guidance of Mordecai, that great Jewish revival, which led to them fasting and praying and ultimately finding mercy as they recommitted themselves to the Lord. It seems that what they quickly perceived was that becoming lax in their observance wouldn't help them. Only through divine help could they hope to survive. Now, that's an interesting thing to think about in the case of today's world, because, you know, there are a lot of people today who would say they're not really Christians. But if you are a Muslim, Anyone who lives in the West is a Christian, whether you're observant or not. And so, perhaps the great reason, or one of the great reasons, for that Eastern Antichrist arising is to force a lot of non-observant Christians to reconsider which side of the conflict they're going to be on in the coming eschaton. Anyway, Haman is called here the enemy of all the Jews. It goes on to say he had devised against the Jews to destroy them. And Haman didn't only wish to see the destruction of the religious Jews, but he clearly understood that should any Jews remain, they would pose a threat to his false religion. Right? They're not members of his religion. So he devised, or invented, as the word means, a very clever plan to see that the Jews were exterminated. Now, earlier in the book of Esther, it simply states that Haman devised a plan against the Jews, and it leaves out this idea of exterminating. The word destroyed here means annihilate. So we see that the motives and intentions of wicked Haman are made plain in order to move the people to rejoice in the Feast of Purim. In fact, his plan left out no Jew in the Persian kingdom. And in that, it's very much unlike that second decree written by Mordecai, which actually spared all the Gentiles except those who remained stubborn and sworn enemies of the Jews. Haman, the son of Hammedatha, of the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and to destroy them. Now we're given here the reason for calling it Purim, lots. Purim is plural in Hebrew. It just means lots. And that's because Haman had cast lots to crush or confuse, or as the King James says, to consume them and to exterminate the Jews. So it's thought that here begins a series of imprecise statements to justify the Feast of Purim. In fact, some of the critical commentators just think, again, that this is evidence that someone other than Mordecai, some other editor, has been at work here. So it said the lots, they say, look, if you look back in the story, the lots were not cast to destroy the Jews, only to determine the day for their destruction. Now, I just want to say, when I read critical commentators talking like that, that seems to me to be a distinction without a real difference. All right, determining the day through means of judicial astrology and casting of lots was not simply an innocent exercise. It was clearly to find a time that Haman and his fellow false worshippers, devil worshippers, would find it to be the most confusing and crushing for the Jews. A day wherein it would seem auspicious to these Persian fire worshippers to make their move against the Jews with the greatest expectation of success. And incidentally, it's been noted that in this clause, a different word is used here that we don't find anywhere else in the book of Esther. It's translated consume, or crush, or, as I point out, confuse. Haman devised to destroy them. The word used is lihumam, which is not used anywhere else. And it's suggested that it's used because it sounds very similar to Haman. It's from an older word, hamam, which generally describes the confusion or the anguish that comes upon people from God. you look at Exodus 14:24, Deuteronomy 2:15. But again, as noted, it may be used here as a play upon the name of Haman. So I think that that's very plausible when we consider that we know the Jews like to make fun of people, their enemies, by changing and distorting their names. We know that they like to do that sort of thing. Right. So, the last verse. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon their own head, his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. But when Esther came before the king. Now here again, there's been quite a bit of discussion amongst the commentators about the inclusion of the name Esther here. In fact, the NIV does not include the name of Esther. Now, the reason for the inclusion of the name Esther is the verb came has a feminine pronoun ending meaning she came. Okay, but when she came before the king is literally what the Hebrew says. And so a number of these critical commentators, they think it's quite artificial to insert Esther's name when Esther's name has not appeared since verse 13 in this chapter. It's not in any of the immediate context of this verse, apparently. They suggest then that we need to look for another word with a feminine, that is feminine, another feminine word. And they suggest that the feminine pronoun ending refers to the plot or the plan. The wicked device. It's translated device here. But in Hebrew, device is feminine. So they would read the verse, but when the device or plan came before the king. And that's actually how the New International Version approaches this. And they find great fault with the King James Version for using the name of Esther here. Now, let me just say that while this may seem to be linguistically possible, our translators knew that the Jews themselves understood the feminine ending as referring to Esther, which is witnessed very clearly in the Targums. The Syriac as well understands it as Esther. And so the ancient witnesses all understood the feminine ending as referring to Esther. And while it may not suggest itself to one reading only this section that Esther's in view, remember, this book was commanded to be read in its entirety each Feast of Purim. And in the broader context of the book, it's hard to deny that it is actually Esther who keeps coming before the king. Not simply an idea such as a plot. Right? Plots and plans are revealed to the king again and again in the book of Esther. But very often, and certainly in this case, Esther seems to be the one who's used to do so. This is not an unreasonable insertion than as these critical thinking people would assert. It's actually, I think, reading and interpreting and translating with the analogy of faith and with a broad view of the book. In fact, I think it makes a lot more sense to put Esther here, because think about this. The whole point is to enforce the keeping of Purim. Now, who could have expected deliverance from such a source as Esther when the king had not even desired to see her for 30 days prior to her going before him the first time? Yet that's exactly what's happened. And moreover, it is perhaps helpful to remember that Esther stands as a representative of the witnessing church. and the church in the Bible is always feminine. Since this book is meant to be applied to each generation, in fact, they're very careful to, the Jews are very careful to tell you that you are to make strict application of this to yourself. Take it to yourself. The simple feminine ending would lend itself better to that understanding if you are part of the witnessing church. When Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, he that is the king, right, gave command by letters. Literally, the Hebrew says, with the scroll. So by or with the scroll is meant, I think, that second decree that was drafted by Mordecai, copied into all the dialects of the kingdom, sent forth with haste by the royal post. Right, so this decree that actually addressed the wicked device or the wicked plan. It was this decree that set forth a counter plan of action and gave necessary permission to the scattered Jews to gather and to prepare for their defense. It was this decree that gave orders to the various governors and rulers to assist the Jews in their defense. It was this decree that gave the Jews a right of preemptive striking against their enemies. By the way, the description of Haman's plan here is, as wicked in the Hebrew, is literally just saying evil, the evil one. Right? Haman's plan, the evil one. And that underscores what the author is trying to do, and that is he wants the Jews to see that the conflict between Haman and Mordecai, or between the Jews and their enemies, is that conflict between good and evil. In fact, all who read the book of Esther are invited to perceive that what's going on is part of a great cosmic fight between good and evil. And to see that the Jews are, at least during this period of their history, they're at the center of the divine purpose to bring good into this fallen world. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews. Here again, we're given a summary of Haman's wicked device. It was devised against the Jews. Now here, too, some commentators object, and they see, as I said, this. They perceive that this section is added by a different hand than the rest of the book, because they say, well, look, Haman didn't devise what he devised against the Jews, but only against Haman. Or, excuse me, only against Mordecai. Now, again, to think that Haman's intention was only against Mordecai is, I think, very seriously to misread the whole book of Esther. It's true, Haman's plan for vengeance arose because of Mordecai. But, and this is important, very quickly, it was not limited to Mordecai. Now here, to help explain this, I think it's proper to make an observation that I don't think that I've made before about Mordecai. In the book of Esther, when Mordecai is called the Jew, and this happens a number of times, it is the first time in Scripture that an individual is called by that name, the Jew. First time the term the Jew, a Jew, is applied to an individual. Now remember, Mordecai was of the tribe Benjamin, not Judah. And yet it is understood that all who acknowledge the existence of the true God and submit to his authority are to be called Jews. Mordecai personifies what it means to be a Jew. He is the Jew. He is the exemplar of what it means to be the Jew in a religious sense. Mordecai believes and is willing to sacrifice his own life for this principle. Hence, he's the Jew. And so it is that when Haman wishes to strike out at Mordecai, he is necessarily going to be striking out at all who are, like Mordecai, Jews. All who hold these religious principles, like Mordecai, who is the Jew. Commanded by letters that his wicked decree, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head. Again, right here we have that surprise in the manner of deliverance appearing in these words. The very evil plot or plan devised by Haman against the Jews, why that returns upon his own head. Now, this is an important observation, because this couldn't simply be the result of human planning. If we contemplate what is being said, no one really could have foreseen such a turn of events. At least not by natural sight. In fact, I would suggest that the poetic nature of the justice that he receives points to a guiding providence. And that should excite in the hearts of the people of God a sense of hope and expectation. Every time you see the enemies of the true religion, you should know they're never going to achieve their designs. When we see the enemies of the true faith rewarded with the very devices they plotted to use against the Church of God, we should not only be not be surprised, right? We should not be surprised. We should be cheerful and we should be thankful. Remember what the Bible tells us. God laughs at the wicked when they plot. He laughs them to scorn. Elsewhere, we're told there's no strength nor prosperity against the truth or the Church of God. And so, although the wicked may seem for a time to have the upper hand, the end has already been pronounced and the outcome is certain. The Hamans of this world are going to be visited with plagues of their own devising. Right? The evil that they devise is going to return on their own head. So finally we're told, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Haman and his son should be hanged on the gallows or the tree. Now here it may sound as if the writer is saying this is all part of the king's decree respecting the deliverance of the Jews. And because of this, again, a number of commentators see this as another discrepancy that shows this these last few verses as being written by someone else, a later editor. After all, if you've read the rest of the book, you know the hanging of Haman and the hanging of his sons was clearly not a single event, and it clearly was not, in fact, even enjoined in one command. But I would argue that to fail to see these things as a single event, as related here, is to fail to perceive the interlocking pieces of the story. It's to fail to realize that Haman's sons are implicated in the plotting of their father from the beginning. You know, it was only a gesture of mercy that gave them an opportunity to flee with their lives. Given the nature of their relation to the elevated position of their father in the kingdom, their sympathies would have been understood to stand with him unless they demonstrated a complete break with his wickedness. You then ever wondered why is it God gives everyone an opportunity under the sun when we've all fallen in Adam? What you've been given is an opportunity to break with Adam's wickedness. But as Paul points out, instead what we do is we imitate the sins of our fathers, particularly our father Adam, and we confirm our guilt in his condemnation. They could have fled. They fled, right? They could flee from the city of Shushan. They could have taken off. They could have demonstrated that they wanted to put distance between themselves and the sins of their fathers. They didn't do that. Now, in conclusion, because we need to wrap this up today, but many, I think many are probably troubled that our story is now turned to reflecting so much on the wicked devices of Haman. There are a lot of people probably would think that, again, this is sort of a non-Christian or anti-Christian mentality. I think instead they would do well to consider that it's part of the ground of the saints' rejoicing to take knowledge of the sin and danger from which they've been rescued. Mercies will appear to be greater mercies when we reflect upon the gravity of the situation which demanded mercy be found in the first place. Purim then was to be a reminder that the very continued existence of the church and people of God could not be laid to their own account, but they must trace it back to the everlasting mercies of the eternal God. Israel, throughout the book of Esther, is found to be leaning on the everlasting arm of God, their Savior. And that was and is and continues to be the only hope of those who remain the church and people of God today. Amen.